Thanks. Yeah, I never lived down that rhyme. Before we get started, I just want to say, for those of you who aren't monitoring the Twitterverse, we did have a change up in our line today. Walter Isaacson's not going to be able to make it. He'll be attending the memorial of Steve Jobs. But today, I have the privilege of introducing two remarkable gentlemen who have an insatiable curiosity for the world. They share a strong sense of adventure and relentlessly follow their passions. Governor Deval Patrick, in 2007, was elected the first black governor of Massachusetts. He's one of only two black governors elected in American history. He began his journey in a poor tenement in the south side of Chicago, where he lived through a chaotic childhood that led to an elite boarding school in New England. He had extensive travels through Africa and managed to take a seat at several Fortune 500 boardrooms across America. He leads a successful career in politics and continues to lead a very extraordinary life. We also have on stage Guy Raz, who joined NPR in 1997 as an intern for All Things Considered. He worked his way up to as bureau chief in London and Berlin and reported from over 40 different countries across the sea. He also covered the war in Iraq while he was there. Currently, he's the weekend host of the show where they first landed at NPR, All Things Considered. And at Google, our culture celebrates the passion to follow your vision, which is why it is a great pleasure for me to introduce today's event as Governor Patrick discusses his incredible story with a call to lead with Guy Raz. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. And as was said, I am not Walter Isaacson. And if you were hoping for Walter Isaacson, now is your chance to leave the auditorium. But hopefully we'll make up for it. Thank you for coming out. Thank you, Governor Patrick.
Thank you, Gavin.
Really for this remarkable and candid book. The basic contours of Governor Patrick's life are well known. He grew up poor, or as it was described to him, broke, not poor.
Right. Because broke is temporary.
Broke is temporary. On the south side of Chicago, through Harvard College, Harvard Law School, and now the highest office in the Commonwealth, forgive me, of Massachusetts. Many of you may have read this memoir, and like me, may have found it both heartbreaking, sometimes difficult to read, but also incredibly uplifting, moving, and very personal. So I wanted to thank you for giving us a very personal window into an improbable life, but really also a remarkable life. I wanted to start, if you could, by painting a picture of where you grew up. What did it look like? What do you remember about that environment?
Well, you have to read the book to find out the answer to the question. But first of all, Guy, thank you for being here today and for standing in for Walter and for the kind comments at the outset. And thank you all for coming in. I didn't think anybody was going to come on a day like this with this much sun after 3 days of rain. So thank you all for being here today. The south side of Chicago, when I was growing up in the 50s and the 60s, was like a southern village. Most of the folks had come in a generation from various places in the south. My grandparents had moved up from Kentucky in the 1920s. It was very much a community in the sense that every child was under the jurisdiction of every adult on the block. You messed up down the street in front of Ms. Jones, she'd straighten you out as if you were hers, and then call home, so you get it two times. We had, most folks were working class, a few of us on welfare, but most people just trying to make ends meet and sharing their whatever they had. It's hard to, my kids just can't quite absorb it, and frankly, when I tell it, it's hard for me to, but we had, horse-drawn wagons in the summer that would, with hay on them, beds of hay, and watermelons being sold, and a guy who used to push a wheeling cart to sharpen knives, and he would call out, and people would bring their knives to the curbside, and he would sharpen them. It was and the schools were kind of a mess, and yet I had some of the best teachers I've ever had in those schools.
I mentioned that you were told, your mother and your would tell you that the family was broke, not poor. But there's an anecdote that you recall in the book, and to me it really captures a lot of your upbringing, and that was a reality of hunger. Your grandmother used to buy one can of frozen orange juice every week, and it was for your grandfather. He was the only one that was allowed to have a glass of orange juice for breakfast. And as a kid, you used to open up the refrigerator on those hot summer days and eye that pitcher of orange juice, knowing that you were not allowed to drink that orange juice. As an adult, your wife would always ask you when you came back from the supermarket, why did you buy gallons of orange juice? And you had to explain this to her.
Yeah, my grandfather worked as a janitor for a bank on the south side of Chicago for 60 years and various other jobs in between, but that was the main job. And he left early in the morning. And every day at breakfast, my grandmother would give him a little glass of orange juice made from a little tin of concentrate she'd get every week. It was just enough for him to have a glass every day. And she had one shelf on the in the refrigerator that was dedicated to her and Poppy, my grandfather. And my mother had another shelf in the refrigerator dedicated to us, my sister and me and my mom. And we were not permitted to take from my grandmother's shelf, especially the orange juice. And it was particularly tough in the summer when you come in hot from playing and you'd open the refrigerator, and there it was, you know, there it was kind of weeping, the condensation on the side, and I would think, well, then no one's going to notice just one sip. But my grandmother always did. So, yes, for a long, long time, I bought more orange juice than we could possibly consume in our house, long past the point when I cared about orange juice, but that's where that comes from.
You know, reading that, I mean, we laugh about it now, but reading that passage in the book really struck me as a father, thinking about my son opening the refrigerator and not being able to do that. And I wonder whether, I'm jumping ahead a bit, but I wonder whether that story that you told isn't necessarily being told today. I mean, we know that the income disparity today is at its greatest point since 1929. There is real hunger in places like the south side of Chicago, in West Virginia, even in Massachusetts.
Walking distance from here.
Why aren't we hearing those stories?
You know, Guy, I was... you've been reporting on and following the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy... Mm-hmm. Have all of you been following this? Yeah. I went down to Occupy Boston right before I came over here, and I've been trying to get down for the last several days when I was not going to cause a lot of noise and a stir, because it's basically I just wanted to be down to listen and try to understand what the range of points of view being represented down there. And people, when you talk to people, when there's a TV camera or a microphone, and so folks seize up. And so I just kind of slipped in today, and a couple of the organizers took me around. They took me into, there's a library tent. It's incredibly well organized. If you haven't been down, I encourage you to go and check it out. There's a library tent, and I went inside the library tent, and there's a whiteboard. And on top of the whiteboard, it says, "Why are we here?" And then there various people write in. And of course, that's the question that I have. One of the things written by one of the participants was, and I'm paraphrasing, I won't quite get it right, exact, was that we have come to accept deprivation and injustice as facts of life, and we ought not. We have come to accept the conditions, you know, that you describe that are not, you know, that are 45 years old in this book, but are current today, and as I say, walking distance from here, as facts of life in the richest nation on earth. And what's so exciting to me about what I am able to discern, I don't pretend to have a complete picture of Occupy Boston or Occupy Wall Street, but what was so exciting about, what is so exciting for me about this coming together is that people are asking themselves fundamental questions whether we ought to accept those realities. And if we ought not, then what are we going to do about it? And I think that's pretty pretty positive thing.
Do you think that this movement will gain traction?
Well, I guess it, you know, it sort of depends on which direction it goes in. Whether I don't know the answer to the question. Mm-hmm. But what I was going to say is, depending on which direction it goes in, I hope so. Because I've, you know, part of what I'm trying to get at in this book is that we actually have it within our individual power and certainly our collective power to shape our own future. We don't have to be to have our future determined entirely by our zip code. And that's a big part of what I'm trying to get across in this book.
You write about this notion of striving to become part of the middle class. This was something that was instilled in you.
Yep.
By your mother, by your grandparents. They also sheltered you from some of the worst racism that was hidden. I mean, you didn't see it. You would take long family car trips, and they would pack lunches because you wouldn't be able to stop along the way for food. You never felt like there wasn't anything you could do. Did you feel different at all? Did you feel like...
The answer is, of course. I mean, this is the 50s and 60s in America, so of course. And when I say that my grandparents were trying to shield us, it wasn't that they were trying to prevent us from knowing what was happening in the world. I mean, I think I also write about this in the book. You knew at a very early age in Chicago that there were parts of the city that were off limits to us, that were just not for us. But they didn't want us to become embittered by it. I mean, a lot of folks, old folks in particular, got the idea. When I say old folks, I mean in the affectionate term that we talk about our... No, but I'm talking about, you know, it's like the old ladies in the church who ran the church. They knew the way the world worked. They wanted us to know the way the world worked, but they also knew that they knew experiences, and I certainly have seen it, where racism drives people right off the edge. And they just, you know, they live a life of bitterness or worse. And my grandparents didn't want that for us because they understood how limiting it was. So it wasn't about preventing us from seeing those realities, but more about preventing us from being limited by those realities.
Your father left when you were just 4 years old, and you write very evocatively about the day he left, your memories of that day. Mm-hmm. And of course, your difficult relationship with your father. First of all, for those of you who don't know, Pat Patrick, the governor's father, is no longer alive, but was a key figure in jazz history. A baritone sax player. First of all, are people surprised when they find that out?
Yeah.
You don't know that?
Yeah, their minds are blown.
I mean, he played with Coltrane. He played with Duke Ellington. He played with Mongo Santa Maria.
Played with Monk. And he was a founding member of Sun Ra, which is
the orchestra.
An avant-garde group. Very much an acquired taste. Should point out that that Guy is a fan. So no, but he was... it's interesting. I didn't know how important he was in on the music scene until I was a grown-up.
And really, I guess until you were about 25, you were in law school,
right.
You were in Washington, D.C., and he invited you to a performance. What happened?
Well, we had my father and I, as you allude, had a very tortured relationship when I was little. I didn't see a lot of him after he left when I was four. And then when I did, they were very strained kinds of experiences. I saw more of him. He moved to New York after he and my mother split. And I saw more of him when I came here to go to Milton Academy because so close to New York. So he tried, we tried to see more of each other. But he was so deeply disapproving of my being at Milton Academy.
He felt that you would lose your identity.
Well, yeah, you're putting it nicely. He thought I was going to turn white and lose my sense of self-respect and my own rudder in a world which my father was very much of the sort of black radical sensibility of the time, well-read in the literature and so on. And so we had a tough time. He came to my graduation from Milton, and he and my mother had a knockdown, drag-out fight that just became center stage. That he didn't come to my graduation from college or law school, I think just avoiding that. We'd had our confrontations in the meantime. But the scene you referred to, the experience you referred to, was on my 25th birthday. I was between my second and third year in law school, and I was spending the summer in Washington at a law firm. And he was doing a gig with a group in Northeast D.C. At a club called Pigfoot.
Pigfoot.
I don't know where the Pigfoot's
still there.
Anymore, no. Okay. No. And he called and said, come on and let's celebrate your birthday together. And I don't think I had spent a birthday with my father since I was 3 years old. But I said, okay. And I went down with the usual, you know, apprehension I felt whenever I was going to
be. And you weren't alone, by the way, right? You went with Diane?
No. I didn't know Diane yet.
You didn't know Diane?
No. I did go by myself. And I went down, and they were in the middle of a number when I came in, and he acknowledged me with his eyes. I sat down, and when it was time for the next number, when they finished that one, he called attention to me. He said, my son is in the house. It's his birthday. And, you know, warm applause. All that. And he said, I want to dedicate this next number to you. And then he played an old standard called I Can't Get Started, which if you don't know, the lyrics are, I think I'll remember them. I've been around the world in a plane. I've started revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I've charted. Still I can't get started with you. It's a beautiful song, and it was incredibly meaningful given our relationship. And he played with this small group, and he just stared at me the whole time, and I at him. And we covered a lot of ground in that time. And I would say if the bridge wasn't completely restored at that point, when Diane did come, my wife is Diane, when Diane did come into my life and my family's lives, that completed it, because she and my father were just thick as thieves.
What do you think he would make of the fact that here you are on the stage, and you've been on much bigger platforms than this one, and you're the governor of this state?
How about that, huh?
You're part of the establishment, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I know.
What do you think he would make of it? I mean, presumably he would be very proud, of course.
Yeah, I'm sure he would be proud. You know, he would... my father is one of a handful of people, most of whom are described in this book, who were very keen on the lesson that you should take no job or do no deed that requires you to leave your conscience at the door. And I think he would be, you know, he's the sort of person, he's like probably bunches of you in this room, certainly bunches of constituents I deal with, who would be very familiar about what it is we were doing and not doing, and call me on it. I hope not publicly, but call me on it. He'd also want to be sure that we were doing what we could to support the arts.
I know that you have been public about the fact that this is your... you will not run again. This is your last term as governor. What... I mean, I know this... You get asked this question, but what do you think happens next for you after this?
I got to get a job. Anybody have any ideas? I'm open. No, I didn't do this because I wanted a career in public life or in politics. I'd like to come back in at some time if I think I have something to contribute, if the moment is right. But I like the payday. I like the private sector, and I miss the private sector on payday. That's what I was going to say. And I'd like to run something, a company or a foundation or something like that, just try some other new things.
Before we get to questions, I want to ask you about just a couple issues that are more related to the political scene today. First of all, let me ask you about healthcare specifically, and forgive me because I'm coming from Washington, and so I don't know all the details about the Massachusetts healthcare system, although my first son was born here at Brigham and Women's and it was great. We really loved it. So God bless Massachusetts.
Thank you. Thank you.
Something like 98% of the residents are covered by health insurance in the state.
99.8% of children.
Of children, which is remarkable. It is the product of one of your predecessors, Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
How much credit does he deserve for it?
You can say it out loud. It's not like he who shall not be named. It's doesn't say it very often, but
should he be? I mean, should he be praised and praised for this plan?
Program? He had a role, and I acknowledge it now, and I acknowledge it at the time. I was a candidate, and I think he expected something different when it was first signed. But he actually called me. I was an unknown candidate, and he called to thank me for saying nice things. Look, the beauty.
Is he still calling you for?
So much. The beauty of healthcare reform in Massachusetts is, in addition to the fact that we have covered virtually everyone, and it's not that we don't still have challenges, and maybe we can talk about those. But that a Republican governor, a Democratic legislature, a Democratic United States senator, the business community, organized labor, patient advocates, provider organizations all came together to invent this thing. And then they stayed together to adjust it as it's gone along. And it's quite fascinating to me that the polling, which I rarely cite, but in this case I will, is overwhelmingly favorable for Massachusetts healthcare reform in Massachusetts. And it's kind of mixed for national healthcare reform, which is the same thing. The same thing. I will say that Governor Romney did a peculiar thing after signing the bill. He vetoed the funding for it. That was then overridden by the legislature, thank goodness. And then it took effect the day I took office. So it's been our task to implement it. And now we're on to the next chapter, which is cost containment. We've got a really exciting bill pending in the legislature around that.
You have had at times a difficult relationship with the media here in Massachusetts.
No.
You've written about it in the book. And Diane, your wife, at a certain point, sought treatment, sought help. Caused depression, and I'm wondering if that has changed now. If you have kind of made peace with that, or is it something that still gets under your skin?
You talking about the media?
Yeah.
No, the media doesn't bother me. Go ahead, say what you want. Ask anything you want. It's interesting. I first of all, Diane is great. She's stronger than ever, and she does something I don't do, which is pour over every inch of the newspaper every day. I just don't do that, I don't tend to read or watch stuff about me. If it's, you know, if it's bad, it'll hurt your feelings. If it's good, it'll go to your head. Better just to leave it alone and keep going. I think that I respect the job that the media has to do, and I think because we understand better what they need from us, the relationship with the media is better. I think, at least from my perspective, any reporters out here can, I hope, speak up. Well, don't speak up too much. This is my turn. I will say, I had this conversation recently with one of the state troopers who is with me a lot of the time, and he was telling me that he will sometimes go home and watch something on television with his family and say to his family, I was there, and that's not what happened. And that's worrisome, right? I mean, apart from how it makes you feel personally, it's worrisome. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to go down to Occupy Boston and kind of take my own measure, because the pressure on the media to distill to very short periods of time, I mean, you have pressure, but there's more respect for the long form or longer form on your program than in many, but you understand what I mean, that this notion of taking a complex scene or subject and distilling it down to something,
Yeah.
You hope to something essential, but and capturing it fairly is a tremendous challenge.
Yeah, indeed it is. I know there are questions in the audience, and I'd love to invite folks to. I think there are microphones here at the front. And if you have questions, please make your way up to those microphones for the governor, and hopefully we can get to as many of them as possible. Sir.
Governor, I just want you to know, first of all, I'm a great admirer.
Thank you.
Voted for you twice, and if you ever did decide to run, I keep voting for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was inspired by your book. I read it. Mm-hmm. What I got out of it most is your sense of decency. You're a very decent human being.
Thank you. There you go. There you go.
And everything you do is admiring at one quality.
I knew there was a butt coming in there somewhere.
I'm a real estate lawyer. What bothered me?
Did you say real estate lawyer? Real estate? Okay, yeah.
And before the crash, and we all hate all those banks now, but when it was going on,
yeah.
The predatory lenders to me were disgusting. They got their name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your association with America.
Yes, yes.
Bad dudes. To the very end, they were bad people. Why? And what can you say about that experience?
So, should I bring others in so we all know what we're talking about? There was a there's a company which I think has since gone out of existence, called AmeriQuest, who's which did prime and subprime lending. And I sat on the board of the holding company AmeriCorps was the holding company. And AmeriQuest was one of the companies who, among other things, bundled the subprimes and sold them on into the securitized market, so-called, which has been a serious problem in the financial downturn. I went on the board. I got to know the company because the founder is somebody we had dealings with when I was in the Justice Department, as you may know. We had issues there about lending discrimination. We worked with them on a settlement, and then 2 years later I left the Justice Department. They were still busy trying to sort out those issues in other jurisdictions, and I went on the board to help them with that. And I served on the board for about 2 years. And as I say, their business was all kinds of stuff, including prime lending, not the subprime part of it. But that part is a worrisome part of my history, just as in yours. By the way, I'm not a saint. Thank you for the nice things you said.
Thank you.
But I'm still learning too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for laying your life out in the book, and also
I kept back some juicy parts, just so you know.
Okay, some of your life out in the book, and also for planting hope, and also even though it's grounded in reality, to plant hope for people. Mm. My question is the challenging aspect of healthcare in Massachusetts. The people that really I'm uncomfortable thinking about every day are the people struggling with mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
As we know, there's been a federal Mental Parity Act, and as we also know, there's been lots of loopholes. So I know of people who are struggling with learning disabilities. These are invisible disorders.
Mm-hmm.
You show up at work, no one knows. One in five people either have depression, learning disability, dyslexia, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
But your colleague doesn't know. And you show up at a doctor, it's very hard. You cannot get insurance. You pay out of pocket. You lose jobs. You have endless loans. You cannot pay for your health care, so you stop going to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
What is happening to these people, and why isn't there more of a dialogue about these people today?
Well, I can't answer the question about why there isn't more of a dialogue beyond my hunch that the same dynamic that you talk about in the workplace, where people are this is my term, not yours, but they're kind of underground. They are they're trying to figure out how not to be noticed, may also contribute to the quality of the public discourse around it. Insurance is available for everybody in the Commonwealth, but it still costs too much, especially for working families, small businesses too. And that, by the way, is not a challenge unique to Massachusetts. As you probably know, that's a national issue. I do think that just as we have been the place to figure out how to extend coverage to everybody, we're going to crack the code on cost as well. And there are communities, including people with mental illness, I would say also people with disabilities, I think are going to be especially well served. But frankly, everybody has a stake in getting system costs down. And when I say system costs, I mean getting the savings on to individual premium payers as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan?
Hi, Governor Patrick. Deborah Rue, can't see me, but...
it's hard to see, but I'm not scowling, it's the lights.
I want to say first, thank you for being the first governor in a while that has stuck around. Learned from the first term and just got better in the second term and didn't abandon us for other callings. I kept thinking, I know as the CEO it's a tough job, mm-hmm. and I think sometimes some of your predecessors didn't realize how tough it was to actually do something like run a state. So thank you. I'm curious about, because, we do know, you're public, and we all read the papers, and in the early days of your first term, there were a few missteps, and what was the biggest learnings for you as a leader? You've led other things before you got here, but, kind of what was the biggest learnings that you've had in the development of your
leadership?
That's a
great question.
Thank you.
And like, you said Deborah, right? Like many of the lessons in this book, Deborah, I think I will, there's still, some of those lessons are still percolating. They're not quite done yet. I think one thing that is a hard lesson for me is that you are never off duty. Never off duty. So if you go to the grocery, it takes twice as long to get through the grocery store than it used to because somebody in the vegetable section wants to, tell you what you're doing right or what you're doing wrong. You know how you sometimes see people in public life and they're always smiling? They're always smiling. And you have a conversation with them and they're still smiling. You're talking about tragedy and they're still smiling and so on. And I now know why, or I think I know why they smile all the time. It's because someone will take that photograph when they're scowling, when they're listening hard, when they have a little indigestion. And that will be the impression from which the public extrapolates a whole sensibility. I still don't do the smiling all the time thing, as you see, because I'm scowling because of the lights. But I do understand that the scrutiny, people get a snapshot, just that they get a second, and they build a whole set of expectations or assumptions, not always positive on top of that. So I think I'm a little bit more careful, but I also want to continue to be me, and as much as possible, I want to continue to have the range of human emotion. I don't want to have just the, I'm the boss. Gear. So that's one lesson I'm sorting.
Sir.
Governor, there's actually one part of your answer I wanted to ask if you could amplify. One of the things I remembered from news media, actually, when your book was coming out, was the controversy about the actual book, in the sense that there were people of a mind that, as a public figure, leader of the Commonwealth, to be taking the time to be doing this sort of thing, controversial, hypothetical. And what I was really pondering at the time and wanted to really ask you to amplify, that delicate balance between a position that's not strictly 9-to-5, where there is no set boundaries, this is what you do, when you do it, how you do it.
Yes.
And then on the other side, that delicate balance between being a husband, a father, and everything else that comes with the job, and how that balances.
Yeah. So in terms of the amount of time it takes, I would say it has taken to write the book, which has been a very new and fascinating experience, writing it and then talking about it. First, a lot of what is in this book I have been writing or talking about for a long time. Also, it's not that big a book. So when I was on Jon Stewart, he made me feel bad. He held the book up and he said, "Will it be bigger when it gets older?" As only Jon Stewart can do. I think for me, you know, my days are very long. I get up very early. I go to bed late. I sleep soundly when I do. But the writing that I did, which was either early in the morning or late at night, or occasionally on the weekends, was a wonderful break from my day job. And you need, this is another lesson, Deborah, you need something to take your mind off of your day job in order to do the day job. Otherwise, it's consumptive. And I mean, not in a good way. I know that Diane also appreciated that, and she loves the book as well, so.
Guy Raz, I'm a big fan. Thank you for coming. Governor, I noticed the name of your book is A Reason to Believe, and the title of this discussion is A Reason to Lead. What do you find is the correlation between leadership and inspiration?
Great question. Well, the kind of leader I want to be and the kind of leaders I admire are the ones who enable us to imagine a different and better and more promising way. Because I think first you have to be able to conjure a picture of what that might be and then build for it. I think both of those components are essential. But I'm not that interested in being the kind of leader, and I'm not that inspired by the kind of leaders who say we just need to kind of worry it along. You know, we have had a whole bunch of governors in the Commonwealth more interested in having the job than doing the job. And that's been true for a long, long time. They're good people. That's not what I'm talking about. But doing the job is a different dimension than having the job. Because if you're doing the job, and if you're doing it from the perspective of generational responsibility, which is what do we do now that's going to leave things better for those who come behind us, it's a whole different order of magnitude. And so the leaders who are in that character of being big thinkers and inspirational leaders who have been who made a difference for me, or range from Dr. King and Winston Churchill to Mrs. Quaintance, my sixth grade teacher.
Just to follow up on that, Governor, what happens though when, of course, referring to our president, who isn't had an inspirational campaign, inspired millions of people around the country. Maybe some of that was projected onto him, but of course it's disappointed many people. Mm-hmm. The promises that they expected from the president. I mean, can you set yourself up to disappoint when you...
Sure, and of course you get a lot of counsel in jobs like this from the political professionals, that you have to tamp down expectations so that you don't have to pay for the disappointment later on. I think that is just the most limiting advice. You know, look, I'm all in for this president. I want to be, I hope that's unambiguous. I am thrilled about this president. I think he's the right leader. I think he's the right leader at the right time. But, you know, I think about, you didn't ask for all this, but here comes. We have an agenda here in Massachusetts that is focused on education, on innovation, and on infrastructure. And even when we have had to cut deeply in a whole host of things, we have invested in those areas. in the case of education and infrastructure, at the highest level in the history of the Commonwealth. And because we've been disciplined about that strategy, we're growing jobs faster than 44 other states. Mm-hmm. We're first in the nation in student achievement. We're first in the nation, it'll be announced next week, in energy efficiency initiatives. We're first in the nation in healthcare coverage. I mean, this isn't unemployment is lower than the national average and going down. We're not done. But there's a difference, I would point out, not in the agenda here in Massachusetts and the agenda that the president has set for the nation, but in the partnership we have. Because the legislature here, despite all the noise about, you know, clashes, has given me the tools. And I think we need a Congress that's going to give this president the tools.
We may not have time to get to all the questions here, but the governor is going to be signing copies of the book downstairs, so perhaps you'll have a chance to ask there. But please, in the remaining minutes, a few minutes we have.
Governor, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
Leadership also often involves unpopular choices and decisions in order to achieve desirable outcomes. And so it's a balancing act, and you mentioned that in an earlier answer to a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. I've worked in the medical device industry for over 30 years, mm-hmm. and as you know, the medical device tax is an important part of healthcare reform. And personally, we need something like that, but of course, as you know, the industry is just absolutely adamantly against it.
Where are you?
Boston Scientific.
No, I didn't mean that. You didn't have to say that.
Sorry, I don't mind.
I love your company, but where are you on the question? Are you do you think medical device tax is a good idea?
I think that we have to do things like this, Governor.
Yeah.
And we have to come up with revenue in order to be able to achieve the objectives associated with health care reform.
Yes. Yes.
And you know, the industry is opposing it, and I'm just kind of wondering, from your perspective, what you think about it, how you see us being able to accomplish the objectives, because the medical device industry is key in our state's economy.
Yes.
And maybe what discussions you've had with President Obama about it.
So I have supported a different kind of financing mechanism than the medical device tax, not because I'm a no new taxes guy, and I don't think that's a dumb gimmick, but because I think it is a worry for our economic interests here. If I can step back from the specific policy, I do feel like we have been, locally and nationally, we have been struggling with how to solve our common problems with one hand tied behind our back, and we are terrified or intimidated in having a conversation about revenue, and we need to get over that. The sensibility of people to say, look, I want to assure that my tax dollars are spent wisely and efficiently, who could argue with that? And we owe it every day, whether we're sailing along with that with plenty of money or just trying to put it together at times when we're under fiscal and financial stress, to continually look for ways to do things smarter, better, faster. But we're getting to a point now where we have squeezed as much out of what we have here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as we can, and we have ended a whole host of programs and activities, some of which should have been ended, and some of which maybe shouldn't have been. In either case, there are views on both sides of that question. And we're going to have a conversation nationally, an adult conversation, about what it is we want government to do, what that actually costs, and what's the best way to pay for it.
We have time for just one more question, and forgive me for that. Go ahead.
It's a good one. Apologies if this wasn't what you were curious about, but I just would like you to speak a little more on the process of writing the memoir and what's the biggest thing you learned and what you would say to others who are trying to get their life story together.
Are you writing?
I'm a writer, yeah.
Yeah. Do you do this professionally?
Trying to. Yeah, have so in the past.
So you should answer this question. It's harder than I thought. I love language. I love the power of words, and so I didn't want to be careless. And so the writing was took a lot of time, even for this little book. I think that for me, and interestingly, Guy, my father had something to do with this. The rhythm of the music of the language is important to me. So I would read aloud to see if the sentences could be done with one breath, if they had the right beat, that kind of thing. I am still a work in process as a writer, but that was very important to me. So the time it takes to read aloud and edit that way is extra time. And then doing it in small parts, you know, I had a fabulous editor, really, really who loved the book and was encouraging at times when I was discouraged, and I'm sure that made a big difference. But she kept saying, look, give me some more. Give me some more detail. I would tell her a story, and she'd say, well, you've told us what you saw, but what did you hear? What did you smell? Were there any tastes involved? You don't understand what I mean? So going through the whole of the five senses. So, but it was fun, and it's fun to have it done, that's for sure.
The book is A Reason to Believe, Lessons from an Improbable Life. If you haven't read it, I would recommend it. It is an incredibly inspiring book, Governor Patrick.
Thank you, Governor.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. And he, of course, will be downstairs signing copies of this book.